A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Coming up on DTNS, Facebook is down, Siri is celebrating a birthday, and guess which space captain is actually going to space? This is Daily Tech News for Monday, October 1st, 4th, rather, 2021. I'm in from Studio Redwood. I'm Sarah Lane.
In lovely Cleveland, Ohio, I'm Rich Straffolino.
And from a balmy Southern California, I'm the show's producer, Roger Chang.
Oh, boy. Before the show, we were talking about all sorts of stuff. And if you would like to get that wider conversation, please do so by becoming a patron of our expanded show, Good Day Internet, patreon.com/DTNS. This is where you can join our top patrons like Alexander Nesef, Hector Bones, and Tim Ashman. Let us start with a few tech things you should know.
Netflix launched its Play Something Shuffle feature globally on Android, with plans to begin testing the feature on iOS in the coming months. The feature was limited to TV-connected devices before. The company also rolled out its Last feature on Android in select markets. It's already available on iOS, which provides funny clips from Netflix content. And Netflix is bringing its Downloads for You feature to iOS this month, which automatically downloads content to watch based on viewing habits, and that is already available on Android.
Apple will open pre-orders for the Apple Watch Series 7 on October 8th, shipping October 15th. The device was originally announced with the iPhone 13, but at the time, only promised it would be available later this fall. Now we know.
Microsoft is launching Windows 11-powered hardware worldwide on October 5th, so one would assume that's when it's coming out. And it is, because it's October 5th in New Zealand, even when it's October 4th in North America. But we're seeing some widespread reports that Windows 11 came out early when it arrived in New Zealand, midday, October 4th, from our perspective.
Qualcomm and investment group SSW Partners announced that they intend to acquire the Swedish automotive tech company Veoneer for $800 million. The automotive supplier Magna International had previously announced it intended to acquire Veoneer last month, but was outbid. Don't feel too bad, though. Veoneer will pay Magna a $110 million breakup fee.
That would make me feel better. A new note from Apple analyst Ming-Chi Kuo claims Apple dropped plans to launch an OLED iPad Air in 2022, citing performance and cost not meeting requirements. Kuo expects mini LED displays to come to the upcoming 14 and 16-inch MacBook Pros, as well as an 11-inch iPad Pro slated for 2022. In other Apple rumors, Bloomberg's Mark Gurman sources say a new Apple Silicon 10-core M1X chip is still on tap for 2021, set to launch with those aforementioned MacBook Pro models in the next month.
The free tier of YouTube Music currently doesn't support background listening, meaning if the screen is off, you're using another app and you don't have music. However, on November 3rd, free tier Canadian users will be able to use background listening on standard ad-supported personalized radio mixes, as well as user-uploaded content. No specifics on when this will roll out to other markets, however. All right, Rich, let's talk a little bit more about what Amazon is up to.
Yeah, some interesting new feature they rolled out. They're letting Prime subscribers in the U.S. send gifts using just an email address or a phone number. You don't actually need the address, it seems. Gift givers do not get access to a recipient's address when sending a gift, so even if they know that information, they don't kind of get the rest of that. Recipients receive an email notification about the gift and can choose to accept, decline, or convert it to an Amazon gift card without the sender knowing it. If they choose to get the gift card, they wouldn't know if they declined it. And if you don't reply to the email, it'll refund the purchase in a couple of days. Amazon confirmed there is no way for recipients, though, to to opt out of receiving gifts entirely.
And I
feel like that's where this is running into some murky waters, right, Sarah?
Yeah. I mean, listen, if somebody is going to send me a gift, they don't know where I live. They don't know the address. They only know that they can do this through Amazon. There's probably not too much of a physical privacy issue going on. But the fact that I might get something that I didn't ask for, don't necessarily want, and could potentially, you know, in a worst case scenario, be stalkerish, I don't like that.
Well, and the other thing is we've been one of the big draws for this from Amazon's perspective is Prime subscribers can send this to anyone. You don't need to have an Amazon account to kind of receive this. It'll prompt you to sign up for an Amazon account if you click on the link. But this seems to me to be like the opposite of all anti-phishing behavior that we've kind of trained people on is like if you get right. an unprompted email from someone, don't click on the link, whatever you do. Now,
yeah,
I know hopefully like. If you get an email from someone, if my brother sent me a gift, I would just text them, be like, hey, did you send me an Amazon thing? Yes. Okay. I feel better about clicking on that. But, you know, hey, click on this to get free stuff from Amazon now has a veneer of this might not be a scam. So you might want to click on that link just in case somebody sent you, you know, a free pair of slippers or something like that. That to me is the bigger issue. Obviously, stalkerware or, you know, however this could be used to make people feel uncomfortable or unsafe, it could be unsettling for sure. But to me, the not having the opt-out for me is a big phishing concern at this point.
Yeah. And I mean, as somebody who gets emails, I'm doing air quotes from Amazon mm-hmm. all the time being like, please, you know, something's wrong with your password, you know, please, you know, like really bad phishing attempts. This is part of life. And I know that the Daily Tech News Show audience mm-hmm. is, you know, you're pretty up on this stuff, but there is something a little unsettling about all of this. And part of it is, yeah, like the gamification of this is, you know, that's one thing. But just the fact that you might get something delivered to you from somebody who doesn't necessarily know where you live, but, you know, wanted to give you a gift, that could be great. Sure, maybe it's from your aunt and it's Christmas or something. But if it isn't, that is something that I think a lot of people aren't totally prepared to deal with.
I do like, though, for the holidays, they do give you that out being like, listen, Aunt Linda doesn't really know what she's doing, but you get that gift card. You could still, well, you know, you still spend it on Amazon. We don't care. We won't tell Aunt Linda. It's fine.
Thank you, Linda. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Facebook news. And boy, is it a Facebook day today. Let's start with the whistleblower situation, which is a story that we've been covering here on DTNS for the last several weeks. The whistleblower who provided documents that served as the foundation for the Wall Street Journal's Facebook Files series came forward as a former Facebook product manager, Frances Haugen. She worked at Facebook for almost 2 years before leaving in May of 2021, so earlier this year, working with the company's civic integrity team. Following the breakup of the team on December 2nd, 2020, she contacted a Wall Street Journal reporter. Documents leaked to the journal came from Facebook Workplace and were open to all employees. So this is something that she had access to, but a lot of other people did as well. Haugen said she expected to be caught by Facebook's internal security as these documents were not related to her position. She's scheduled to testify before Congress this week and filed with the SEC for federal whistleblower protections. With the civic integrity team, Haugen focused on issues around how Facebook could impact global elections. She described Facebook using understaffed teams to build tools to deal with larger issues like malicious targeting of specific communities and detecting and combating human exploitation. Haugen described the civic integrity team as an understaffed cleanup crew. In a written response to the story, Facebook spokesman Andy Stone said, quote, "We continue to make significant improvements to tackle the spread of misinformation and harmful content. To suggest we encourage bad content and do nothing is just not true," end quote. In completely unrelated news, but I mean, here we are, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Messenger, and even Oculus VR are all currently down as of this recording, going offline around 12 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, rather, on Monday. According to Cloudflare, Facebook's BGP routers have been withdrawn from the internet. Facebook is showing a generic error message, while Instagram shows a 5XX server error message. This appears to be impacting internal Facebook services as well. In fact, there are some folks who work at Facebook who say, yes, we cannot communicate with our other Facebook brethren. Everything is down. Social features and downloading new game functionalities are also offline. Basically, Facebook's DNS records, things that tell computers where to find the servers associated with Facebook's domain names, all gone. Facebook controls its own domain servers, so it's likely not an attack, but more to be a configuration error, either by design or a mistake. Hard to say. So when you try to go to Facebook.com, the internet just responds with a version of, I don't know what that is. I don't know where you want to go. That would affect every Facebook and Facebook-related service, including internal emails and tools. Twitter user CPK underscore KC suspected the configuration error may have made it impossible to fix itself remotely since the domains are all gone, meaning that they would have to get physical access of the machine to restore service. Or, as Tom put it on Twitter, Facebook seems to have done the equivalent of putting the autoexec.bat in the autoexec.bat because Tom loves an Asian DOS reference.
Yes.
Rich, so, I mean, Rich, I don't even know where to go with this. It's so weird. This has been the weirdest day. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are like, oh, well, I don't even use Facebook. Doesn't apply to me. Well, you know what? Billions of people do. And this is downtime like I've never seen before.
I was texting a friend that this is like being on the internet in 2002 or something like that, where you're like, I guess, where do we go? I can't share a picture, you know, stuff like that. I know there's plenty of other platforms that can do that. Going back to the whistleblower story just really quick, since we're still kind of waiting for, I'm assuming Facebook's going to figure out how to bring up services. My instinct says this is a blackout. Like, this does nothing given the news of the day. Like, this has to be a technical error and someone's just having the absolute worst day possible on their technical end. In terms of the whistleblower stuff, there's not a lot of new news on this. The 60 Minute piece that came out kind of in conjunction with this disclosure, this whistleblower coming forward, kind of reiterates a lot of the reporting that was already out there. The thing that stood out for me, and I just think is very bizarre, is that whole thing about this, all these documents that she pulled were from Facebook Workplace. This wasn't her like using someone else's credentials or creating a shadow identity that, you know, had some sort of access. She literally was just going through there, like just looking through old slide decks, looking up old researchers and kind of looking at their notes and stuff like that. And the fact that, you know, insider threats are like a huge corporate security priority, and there are solutions out there that will analyze traffic patterns and how you're accessing networks and stuff like that. That to me is a huge eyebrow raiser, that nothing that she was doing kind of going outside of her domain, accessing all these files, downloading those files, didn't raise any red flags over the course of seemingly months to get to that point. You know, and in the story, you know, she kind of even like was putting in her search history kind of like a goodbye to Facebook at a certain point. So that to me is the main kind of like eyebrow raising. You know, it kind of fills out the story of why these disclosures were coming out there. Certainly that's very important. But like not anything I think particularly new, other than, yes, Facebook was devoting resources to a lot of these very important issues on their network, but seemingly you know, putting a lot of pressure on very small teams to solve very huge issues, which, you know, some obviously Ms. Haugen sound that as being, you know, not enough, inadequate, or, you know, an understaffed cleanup crews, she said.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't cover all, blackouts of various platforms because these things happen. This is a pretty significant blackout. And not only for all the people who use Facebook products, but all of the people who work internally at Facebook. And from, you know, what I've gleaned from folks who do work internally, I mean, it has crippled a very, very large company. And again, this is as of recording, who knows when it will be turned back on or fixed, but pretty big news for a Monday.
And I'm sure we'll cover the details of what actually happened when and if those come out. Indeed. But if you maybe were taking the time with Facebook and all those other apps being down, maybe doing some online shopping, you probably noticed some buy now, pay later services wherever you were checking out. You know, this is something that has really been on the rise in the past couple of years, especially we've kind of seen that surge in the U.S. This is considered a form of consumer credit and is still relatively small in terms of market share, has about $97 billion in volume, and that's about 2% of the global consumer credit market in 2020. $97 billion, a lot by my standards, but not by the global credit market. But with younger consumers, they're increasingly wary of large credit card balances, and they've hit their lowest level since 2017 last year. So this is making more traditional credit companies kind of take notice of these services. In January 2018, Affirm owned the buy now, pay later market in the U.S. with over 95% of market share. Since then, foreign competitors have entered the market, with Affirm now third behind Afterpay and Klarna, so just, you know, in a couple of years. All of these services have or will have big e-commerce partnerships. Affirm is partnered with Amazon and Shopify, not small fish there by any means. Afterpay is in the process of being acquired by Square and kind of going after more of that, you know, that mega shopping all-in-one app kind of experience. And Klarna is targeting traditional retailers like H&M, Walmart, Sephora, and in Germany, where they have an even larger presence, you know, and these buy now, pay later services in general in Europe kind of have a bigger market share. They're actually operating as a bank in Germany. So kind of, you know, very different ways of approaching this, all kind of offering that same core service. The draw here for merchants, because this is something I've always kind of hadn't dug into, is like, why would a merchant necessarily want to? Buy now, pay later options get better conversion rates and overall higher purchases, often without having to discount goods as steeply to move them. The trade-off here, though, is that merchants reportedly pay between 3 to 8% of transactions for most of these services, much higher than traditional, just card processing fees or stuff like that. But, you know, not having to put a big discount to clear merchandise, kind of a big deal. I mean, Sarah, I'm sure you have seen, no lack of these kind of services at checkout, right?
Indeed. I don't know. I feel like a story like this is sort of like, well, you know, look at these financial shifts based on, you know, human buying behavior to me. And please, you know, check me if I'm missing something. It's like, this is just credit card companies being like, this is how we prey on people who can't afford things. And we actually get more money out of them in the long term. And it's just presented to the customer as something different and something better.
I've seen this compared to something like layaway, even though in this instance, you're actually like getting the good, you know, kind of ahead of time. I mean, really what it comes down to for a lot of these companies with these kind of partnerships, especially I think with Afterpay and the Square acquisition, is really trying to own that customer relationship when it comes to anything revolving payment processing, whether it comes to credit, you know, short-term credit, long-term credit, or just immediate payment processing, just kind of owning that whole experience, owning all that information that comes along with it, which can be incredibly valuable. That acquisition has not gone through, still waiting to close on that. So we will see if that does come to pass. But an interesting, you know, need to keep a bead on this, given how quickly it's kind of ramped up. And, you know, we have rumors that Apple is looking to possibly get into this market with Apple Pay. All of the big payment processors are also kind of looking on how to get into this market as well. So definitely not something that's going away. So kind of I thought it was important to, you know, kind of talk about. What are the implications of this? Who's what benefit of it? What's causing the rise of this? And I thought the source of this was a really great protocol series. So definitely want to check that out if you want some more information.
Indeed. And we will be following the story as it unfolds. If you're interested in video gaming, we talk about video gaming here on DTNS. Maybe you don't have time to follow all the stories. You can check out DTNS Gaming News Monthly. Every month, Jen Cutter rounds up the biggest video gaming news in about 15 minutes. Whether you're already a hardcore gamer or thinking about getting into video gaming, the monthly summary will bring you up to speed. Just look for it in your DTNS feed. And thank you to Jen Cutter for doing the work.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
All right, let's talk about a little bit of an anniversary that we have to celebrate today. Apple announced its humble personal assistant, Siri, 10 years ago today at the launch of the iPhone 4S. If that doesn't make you feel old, I don't know what will. Remember that? iPhone 4S. Yes, that is when Siri was announced. According to Apple's Phil Schiller at the announcement, quote, "What we really want to do is just talk to our device. And your device, in that case, your phone, will figure out what you mean and help you get what you want done," end quote. It was quickly followed by Samsung's S Voice, Google Now in 2012, then Microsoft's Cortana, Amazon's Voice Assistant in 2014. Voice assistants are a big deal now, but, you know, just 10 short years ago, it was kind of novel. While being one of the first personalized virtual assistants in comparison to Siri's rivals, it hasn't really capitalized on its first mover advantage, however. Reporting on the years has laid blame to various factors, from Google's larger trove of user data to train its voice assistant, to confusion with Apple over what Siri's focus should actually be, to a slower annual update schedule, and lack of third-party supports.
Yeah, I mean, when that I very distinctly remember that 4S launch. It's like my favorite iPhone design, so whatever reason that sticks out. But like Siri did, like at the time, and looking back at the reviews, the Verge did a great job of kind of profiling the reviews back in 2011. You know, very glowing, very, oh, this, you know, it's a game changer with virtual assistants, kind of definitely grading it on a curve in a lot of ways. Yeah. But looking at, you know, up until that point, my experience with most voice assistants had been like Google's 411 service. I don't know if everybody remembers that, but like, you know, that was all like kind of automated voice prompts. And it, you know, it was pretty hit or miss. Or like, I mean, I remember like my dad had an old cell phone where you like literally had to train it how to like say people's, how you said people's names so that you could call them. And the fact that it could, you know, Siri could handle a lot of very basic tasks seemingly within some very narrow confines did feel like a big improvement. And, you know, not to poo-poo where Siri is at right now. There's a, like, if you're in the Apple ecosystem, right, and you're, you know, you have your iPhone in your pocket with your Apple Watch and your AirPods, it is a very, like, that is an ecosystem where you can do a lot with voice. And I think that is where Siri's kind of focus now is kind of allowing you to extend, and even with the HomePod and stuff like that, being able to extend that, have a very consistent feel. Whereas a lot of other ecosystems, when you're talking about Google, yes, it works very well on a phone, but if you don't have that whole ecosystem and there's maybe less of a reason to buy into it, you know, it doesn't have a problem. Still, though, I think that's been the narrative kind of dogging Siri. It's like it's usually like considered, I don't know, maybe second best. And, despite being the earliest, seems unusual for Apple one to be earliest and kind of not to have the most refined experience out of the box is, I think, what always raises eyebrows with that.
I have to say, I mean, I remember when, you know, Siri launched, at the time I was commuting in my car a fair distance to, you know, my place of work. And so because I would be like bored in my car for an hour at a time, you know, I would just be like, Siri, tell me, you know, 2 + 2, or, you know, hey, what's the giant score? You know, I was trying to like trip her up. Right? Mm-hmm. All right. Trip him up. Siri is, you know, omnipresent and it has no gender. But you know, at the time it was like, I was like, this is really cool. But like, how helpful is this to me outside of the fact that I'm, you know, in a car and I can only really, you know, use voice stuff to get answers because I can't look at my phone. I mean, 10 years ago, that was sort of Siri to me. Was like, oh, this is like really helpful when it would be dangerous for me to look at my phone while driving. And the fact that the virtual assistants, you know, dime a dozen, you know, and they mostly work the same way. And the fact that the Internet of Things devices in the home has exploded. All of that, you know, the whole Siri thing was back in the day was like, oh, I just, you know, tell my phone to give me like a easy query and it will, that's Siri. And now it's, you know, it's, AppleKit, you know, or HomeKit rather, or, you know, it's a variety of other platforms that all do the same thing. And that is now what we think of voice assistants as. And that happened very quickly. You know, it didn't take that long for us to be like, yeah, I got it. Yeah. You know, you can participate or not, but, It's funny how these things get adopted so quickly.
Yeah, I will say perhaps the most enduring like kind of legacy, I don't want to say that about an actively developed product, but like the idea that like a voice assistant has a personality, definitely, mm-hmm. you know, that I feel like we can always look to Siri as the starter of that trend for sure.
Indeed.
All right. Well, we've covered the semiconductor shortage on a number of levels on the show, from the impacts to consumer technology, very obviously, to national security implications, and even venturing into the automotive industry. Now, a production cut on silicon metal in China has sent prices up over 300% in the last 2 months. China's Yunnan province accounts for about over 20% of the country's silicon output, but that was ordered to cut production by 90% through the end of the year to curb energy usage. It's just kind of an ongoing story within China. It's why they were seeing a big crypto crackdown there as well. Silicon is obviously used to make semiconductors, but also has a wide range of other uses, from being the raw material in silicone to uses in concrete and glass. This could continue to hammer automakers, where silicon is part of aluminum alloys used in engine blocks. Silicon is also used in the solar industry for photovoltaic panels, with the cost of solar-grade polysilicon to its highest levels since 2011. However, this recent shortage has done nothing, seemingly, to curb investment in semiconductors so far. We'll see if that continues, though. Crunchbase reports that global venture funds semiconductor startups hit $3.7 billion in August, already surpassing 2020's previous record year. U.S. venture funding had already surpassed 2020 levels back in April and now stands at $1.6 billion of funding as of August.
It's like toilet paper, but for, you know, silicone.
Yeah, the shelves are empty of all of our,
There's some hoarding going on here. This is not surprising to me, Rich.
Yeah, well, what is surprising, I guess, is this. I am very curious to see how far we'll see this kind of China energy crackdown, basically, or this concerted effort by China's central government to essentially bring down energy usage throughout the country. What other industries and knock-on effects we will see? You know, we could production of silicone, and thinking, how does that impact chip manufacturing, which already was strained for a variety of other factors? Like, it just seems like this semiconductor shortage can never catch its breath, for lack of a better term. And given how essential China is to just kind of the global supply chain, even with ongoing sanctions and stuff like that, undoubtedly we will see further knock-on effects to this. It sounds like from the pieces I was reading, like the solar industry probably is the most insulated from this. But, you know, automakers already kind of globally halting production kind of across a number of different lines. And, you know, if it goes from not having enough chips for backup sensors or for, you know, the ton of on-suite security to, hey, we can't make engine blocks, you know, or it's much more expensive to make them, that's, you know, that not great news for them.
Indeed. And also anybody who's like, what's the difference between silicon and silicone? Well, it's hard to know. You know, look it up. All right. We've got some good news for William Shatner. There's some William Shatner fans out there. The man is set to become the oldest person to fly to space at 90 years old. That's right. Shatner is set to fly on Blue Origin's second tourist space flight on October 12th aboard the New Shepard and will break the record of 82-year-old aviation pioneer Wally Funk, who flew on New Shepard back in July. Sadly, the flight is only scheduled to go past the Kármán line boundary between the Earth's atmosphere and outer space, well short of a second star to the right and straight till morning. I know that you... people who understand space understand that joke, and I had to be told about it between Roger and Rich before the show. But I got to say, William Shatner, y'all, 90 years old, ready to go to space. God bless you.
I mean, I remember when it was a big deal when John Glenn, I watched that in school. I remember we shut down class to watch John Glenn go up as a senior citizen, go up into space. I do kind of feel bad for Wally Funk. You know, he gets like the privilege of being the oldest guy in space for like 4 months.
Yeah, it's like you were 82, dude. I mean, William Shatner's 90. Yeah. By the way, William Shatner's 90. I'm both surprised but also not surprised
by that revelation. No, but hey, no. I mean,
it's the role he was born to play.
I think that says something to the, I want to say maybe the smoothness of the flight. Like, I don't know. Like, obviously this clearly puts strain on a body. I hope William Shatner is okay at 90 years old, but like, I feel like this isn't like the same level of, hey, we're going to the moon, like bullet shooting out of a gun going up. I hope, that Bill makes it back okay. That's what I'm saying.
Before we move on, Wally Funk, woman.
I apologize.
Wally, we appreciate you. And
now I feel extra bad for Wally Funk.
Listen, damage. Wally Funk is Wally Funk, and she has done great stuff, and she will never be forgotten. Before we put our foot in our mouths anymore, Rich, check out the mailbag.
Well, we got an email from Toby on the Fairphone, and they say, it seems to me that it is a great option for the security conscious. The ability to get inside the device easily and physically disconnect and remove components is a very low-tech and relatively low-skill way to de-risk the device for sensitive environments. I had forgotten about the Fairphone until the DTNS piece, but even as an iPhone user, I'm now giving it serious consideration, having taken a look at what I actually use, especially now as more computing time is done from my desk with increased work from home. A 5-year warranty and replaceable battery seems compelling.
Yeah, it really does. I'm with you on that, Toby.
The one thing I will say is, if you can open it, anyone can open it. So as long as it's in your physical presence, it is good for the security conscious. That would be my only caveat to that. I mostly agree with you in principle.
Well, if you have any feedback for us, like Toby, or questions, comments, anything we talk about on the show or might talk about on a future show, please do send that feedback our way. Feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com is where to send the email, and thank you in advance. We would also like to extend some thanks to our brand new bosses. We got a few of them over the weekend. Martin Israel, Nathan Ernest, Mike, and Plumber Sanderlin, who all started backing us on Patreon. So thank you, Martin. Thank you, Nathan. Thank you, Mike. And thank you, Plumber. And thank you to all our patrons who support us every day. We could not do it without you. Reminder that we're live on this show Monday through Friday, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live. Thank you to everybody who joins us live. And if you'd like to, please do. Tom's back tomorrow, and we'll be joined by Nate Langson. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.